Hello, this is Scott Wells for The Magic Word. While I was at the East Coast Mind Jam earlier this year, I visited with mentalist Bill Gladwell, who told me an incredible story. He had been a hypnotist for a number of years, but wanted to take his career in a different direction by trying something extraordinary. He approached theater owners in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, with an idea of performing a one-man mentalism show. They bought the idea contingent upon them seeing what he could do and what the show would look like. Essentially, they wanted to see his show first, live. The problem was, he didn't have a show. In fact, he wasn't even what we would call a mentalist at the time. What he did next is the subject of part of this podcast. We are joined by Keith Fields, a British transplant, who supplements Bill with a show in the same theater with his comedy show. Keith talks about his experience with landing the job, plus his background as a street entertainer and comedy club headliner. Keith is also a contributor to the free online magazine, Vanish, which I recommend that you download and read. It's great material by top pros and is all free at vanishmagazine.com. Thanks for your continued support of The Magic Word. I appreciate your suggestions and advice and hope that you will continue to send me your emails at themagicword@scottwells.com. Your financial support is especially appreciated. To become a friend of The Magic Word, please send your donations through PayPal to scottwellsmagic@gmail.com. But whatever you do, and however you get your information from The Magic Word, please help spread The Magic Word and tell your friends about this free podcast. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast, and today I have as my guests not one, but two very unique gentlemen who are working in a show in Tennessee. I've got Bill Gladwell. Hello there, Bill.
Hey, Scott. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And I also want to welcome Keith Fields. Hello there, Keith.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the internet world.
There you go.
Well, can I just ask, actually, before you go any further, is this just video or is this audio?
You probably should get dressed.
Ah, that's good.
Yeah, put on your pants.
Okay, so I just wanted to check that because I was just making myself comfortable. And I haven't taken my medication, so anything could happen.
Oh, then perfect. Then we're just at the right time. Okay, good. Are they serving pudding at the home there tonight?
Yes. Hopefully custard and mashed potato, just so I don't have to chew.
You can gum it. Now, I wanted to talk with you guys today because I think it's kind of interesting. You know, Bill, you and I were chatting at the recent East Coast Mind Jam up in New Jersey about your show and had you on my little talk show there. But for a lot of people who may not have heard that, and some who did would like to know some more information about this, I thought it was kind of fascinating. I'm going to have you recount the story here shortly. Basically, for those who don't know, that you have a one-man show in Tennessee, and is it Gatlinburg or Pigeon Forge, actually?
Gatlinburg.
Yes, don't mention that Pigeon Forge place to us.
Okay.
We don't like them over there.
Well, that was what I was going to ask. For people who want to come to see the show and we're flying in, Knoxville is the closest major airport, isn't that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, if you will call it major, that is it, yes.
Yeah, it's a bit of a generous term, I feel.
Otherwise, you're parachuting into Gatlinburg.
That's right.
So Gatlinburg's kind of nestled in the it's not really the Smoky Mountains, is it?
Oh, it is, yes, the Smoky Mountains.
And nestled is such an appropriate word for it because it really is right at the base of the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful, actually, around here, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. Pretty, very pretty.
You know, I have I went snow skiing there in the summer in Gatlinburg. I took some friends there once who had never skied, and we lived in Illinois at the time. And there was, I don't know if there still is, and you can tell me, there was a mountain that was covered in some sort of carpet material. It looked like sauerkraut or something, you know, kind of like AstroTurf. Basically, that you just had this one run, and you could rent skis and kind of take the lift up the top of the mountain and ski back down. It was part of your year-round ski.
I don't know anything about that, so that may have been gone a while back.
I have seen dry ski slopes before. We have them over in the UK, but I haven't seen any since I've been in the States.
Not here, no. Okay. We have the only ski lodge in Tennessee is here in
over
Gatlinburg.
Over Gatlinburg.
But they don't have sauerkraut. It's got real snow.
Yeah.
Real snow. Just certain months out of the year, then.
Yeah. through the winter there, all the snow machines and everything up there. It's worth a trip. Again, fantastic place.
Well, I know that you guys certainly get the snow because so many years ago that I was there when we had a quite a snowstorm during the middle of the convention, not the Jubilee, what was the Magic Convention?
The Winter Carnival?
Winter Carnival, and it truly was winter, and I remember that Giovanni and a bunch of us were all snowed in, and the cool thing was that, no pun intended, the next day that they actually extended it an additional day because we couldn't get out, and they couldn't get food in, and people couldn't get out, and so they kind of said, okay, what do you want to do? So I remember Steve Beam performing something with snow balls, you know, color changing snowballs, and I don't know, he had a bunch of funny gags and things. And other people said, you know, do you want to be in tonight's show or do you want to do close up? You got another lecture or something else you can talk about? And so we just had an additional day of, because it was 24 hours, we had 24 inches of snow. It was just an incredible blizzard. And that was long about, when would that have been? Around 88? Somewhere in there, possibly.
Good old days. I remember 1988. Yeah.
I was a junior in high school.
There you go. Well, then you were hardly even born then whenever I went skiing back there in Gatlinburg. That would have been about 1975. So it would have been a while back, even further. So enough about me and back over to you guys. So
yes, let's talk about us. That's our favorite subject.
There we go. Something that you know more about. And the show, again, what is the title of the show?
Well, there's two. Keith has his show, and I have my show, both at the Iris Theater in Gatlinburg.
Well, you tell him about yours, and then I'll tell him about mine. How about
okay.
that?
Okay.
All right, I'll do
Does that.
That
work? Or you can tell him about mine, and I'll tell him. You know, you probably know more about yours.
Let's just talk about each other.
Well, I'm a mentalist. Scott, I don't know if you mentioned it on the podcast, but if people have listened before, I am a mentalist, and I've been doing this for a while. And the show is called Headcase here. So I do an hour and 15, hour and 20-minute show. It's strictly straight mentalism, and it's highly interactive with the audience.
Mm-hmm. And when you say highly interactive, do you do some things with the entire audience, or most of your audience interaction has to do with volunteers coming up on stage?
I do one or two things with the entire audience, but for the main part, it's a 90-seat theater that we perform in, and I use approximately 30 people up on stage during every show.
Wow. Well, you know, when Mark Salem and I had a podcast, we were chatting about the structure of a show, mentalism as opposed to magic. Specifically with magic, that you kind of got some, peaks and valleys where that you take the audience for an emotional roller coaster, whereas with mentalism, it seems that you have to continually build on an effect. You can't do a weak effect because you've already proven you have a certain power, and if something is weaker than the one you did earlier, then it's like, well, what happened to your powers? Do you structure your show kind of like that? Does that make sense? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, and I keep that in mind when I do structure the show. I start off with things that appear very easy, and then they build on one another because I want to take people through that process of something that they think that they can do or feel that they can do sitting here in the theater. And I explain through my show that everything that I do is something that you can learn, but it gets progressively more difficult as we get to the end.
So do you start off with a square circle for an example of something that you can kind of show, well, these are powers that you can have also if you just practice your arithmetic?
Yeah, up until last week I was starting off with saying the alphabet backwards. Then I would go into a magic square routine, and I would explain that my 11-year-old daughter can do the magic square now within about 15 seconds with any two-digit number. And I teach them I don't teach them how to do that, but I explain that they could learn how to do that.
Now, you said you did that up until about 2 weeks ago. Why did you make a change in your routine?
I still do the magic square at the start. I dropped off the alphabet, and I am adding a bank knight to the first part and making it into, basically I step on stage and I say, a lot of people will come up to me after the show and want to know if I use what I can do for my own benefit, and let's do an experiment to see if I can. And I go into that, and that's the first thing that I do now.
Let's not talk about that for just a minute. And Keith, I'm going to get to you in a minute.
That's okay. I've been out for the room. We've got a whole arcade the other side of the spring. I just went out there and played a few machines.
Okay. That's a pachinko I hear in the background or something. On the bank night, my question about the bank night would be, to me it seems that when you say you're starting off with that now, maybe I don't have a good routine or I haven't worked this out enough. I've done some bank night routines, and I always feel like it's a sting kind of a thing. In other words, I feel like, you lose, I win. You know, I love John Archer's blank night routine, and I've done that for a while. But at the end, you know, it's like, okay, so you guys have all have gotten these other fake coupons or bills or whatever that you have in the envelope, but I end up with the $100 bill. You selected the wrong one, so haha, you lose, I win. How do you get over that sting of that particular trick? That is the inherent flaw I find with a bank night routine.
It could be, and the way that I look at it is the whole routine is second to what I'm doing. What I'm really doing is building that rapport with the audience. And so when I come out, it's more of presenting my personality and getting to know the people, so it gives me a chance to, the people that I do pick, to ask them their names and where they're from, and to let the rest of the audience see that I'm, you know, very likable and I'm very easy to get along with, so there's no reason that they should be apprehensive to come on stage with me or let me choose on them or choose them.
Right.
And so it doesn't come across as, the ha-ha thing. Like
that you have powers and you're better than they are, whatever.
That's right. Keith and I were just talking before we connected here. And, I was telling him that I do a lot of corporate gigs. And the corporate gigs that I do seem to be somewhat more interactive. And I like them not better, but they're a different animal. And the reason is because I have to please one person, and that's the meeting planner. And in the theater, I have to please every person in each seat because they've all purchased tickets for $25.
Right.
And so when I'm doing the mentalism, I watch TripAdvisor and I get the feedback on email and other avenues. And since 2012, when I started here, the show has morphed into what the people like in this area. And I can't go on with an extended explanation of how I did things or a big build-up on each bit that I do, mm-hmm. because the audience gets bored. And so, it's not speed mentalism, but it's not slow-paced either. So I keep it moving along pretty quickly.
Are you saying the good audiences in Gatlinburg have short attention spans?
I think that's what I'm saying, yeah.
I thought you were.
So it's a drinking audience.
Gatlinburg? The only drinks are is the moonshine tastings. Which is free moonshine, people.
And Bill, do you see yourself kind of as a comedy mentalist? I mean, or is it just some comedy that happens to be injected in there? I'm thinking, for an example, I've seen Tim Conover work. I remember many times that it was very funny, the kinds of things that he did, but it was also just the situation was funny, it's so mysterious. It's like, wow, that was any. The way he kind of, danced on the balls of his feet and different things that he did, and he always had a smile on his face. Whereas some other mentalists seem, let's say like Max Maven, that might have more of a serious look, or Eugene with, that kind of a voice that really makes things more serious. Do you see yourself then really, obviously you're a family mentalist and have families who come into the show, and this is a family-oriented type of a show, but what is your character and what are your powers, quote?
Oh, got it. I play it straight, but I'm not a Max Maven, so I'm not that serious. I am not a comedian, though. I don't do stand-up. But
that's why you got Keith. Keith does his show.
That's right. There are laugh points throughout the show, so it's the situations are humorous, and I do crack a joke every once in a while, but it's not a story. It's just a one-liner that would fall, and it falls within the show. And, it's right. The same show every night with different numbers. And it is funny. And if I don't get laughs through the show, I think there's something that's been going wrong the whole time. So I do have laugh points built in, and I do look for those because that helps me gauge the audience as we go through it.
And then what kind of powers? I mean, some people might you're projecting. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I did therapy for a long time.
but he's getting better.
I'm getting
now.
Better now. I conducted therapy. I had three therapy offices in Columbus, Ohio before I moved down here. And so I got really good at reading body language in the therapy room. Now, it's a little bit different on stage, and there's some other things going on. But that my powers are not predictions. I used to do spoon bending and metal bending, and I don't do that anymore.
Psychokinesis, yeah.
Yeah, so what it is now, it's more about reading people and influencing people. So that's what I tell them when I come out on stage. I read minds, and I read and influence your mind. And I'm very blatant about it. I know the big thing in the mentalism world now is the
disclaimers.
Disclaimers, yes. I couldn't remember the name. And so when I come out on stage, I'm very blatant. I said, look, for the next 75 minutes, I'm going to lie, steal, and cheat. And that's the only disclaimer that I give.
Mm-hmm. Rather than afterwards, people thinking that you have certain powers. You don't imply that you do or don't. Just kind of let them draw their own conclusions, I guess.
I do, yeah. Paul Veal, when we listened to his lecture out at Mindvention, you know, said if people come in believing that you can do a lot of the stuff that you say you can do during the show, you have more problems coming in than what I can give you. And I kind of agree with that, although I do need to give the disclaimer that, listen, I'm going to lie, steal, and cheat, so keep an eye on me through the rest of the show.
Yeah.
That is a huge conversation, though, and we've had this conversation at this end, and I've had the conversation at various mind conventions that I've been to as well, about the impact of what mentalists do on their audience, because we are playing with people's belief states. And it is a question that I think every mentalist has to ask of themselves. I don't think there's one answer.
No, I don't think so.
There's not one answer that fits all, because it depends on the mentalist and how they're selling it. But I think it's a question that you should ask of yourself if you're going to do mental stuff.
Well, why do you think then, Keith, that perhaps one mentalist is more successful than the other? And I say successful in terms of the audience size. Let's say where some people, they may be well known among the magician and mentalism community, but those who actually make their living and have shows and, you know, pack theaters or, you know, have audiences come, whether it's for college circuit or whether it's, you know, a legitimate theater or wherever, you know, I'm judging success by numbers of people who come in, whereas some other mentalists might come in and they have their own perception of you know, what their powers are.
Yes, I think actually there's so many, I mean, the business that we call show is such a complex beast, mm-hmm. and very few people have got a real handle on it. And I think that actually the number of people that come to see our shows has very little relevance on how good or bad our shows actually are.
But word of mouth has a lot to do with bringing
people
back. Oh,
absolutely, that has a lot to do with it. And there are some people who do amazingly good shows and have very few people in the audience, and some mm-hmm. people who do amazingly mediocre shows but are selling out.
Why do you think that is?
A marketing thing. Than it is a show thing. I think, you know, your show has to be of a good enough standard. But the difference between, you know, good enough and very good, most audiences haven't really, they haven't seen that many mentalists. They haven't seen that many magicians. They haven't seen that many comedians even. If the mentalist read my mind, he did a good show. They've got nothing to compare it to. So unless they've seen three or four mentalists, the audience aren't really the best judge of whether it's a good show or not. It's more about something that you say in your show, Bill, about did I meet and exceed your expectations?
Yes, sir.
If Bill does that, then he's done a good show. Even if, I mean, I'm not saying Bill's show is a bad show, but if it was a bad show and he said, have I met and exceeded your expectations, and they said yes, from the audience's perspective, it would have been a good show. Do you get the point?
Yep, I have.
I've seen Bill's show. I know it's a great show. That was not the point. But for so many, it's as much about the marketing side of it as it is about its show and its business. And so many times we rely on the show to do the business. The show itself is not enough. It doesn't matter how good your show is. You need a marketing machine behind you.
Well, that's true. But kind of going back to the belief systems, particularly with mentalism shows that people bring to the audience, to the show. I was just talking with Eric Rumiston recently about Close Up, and he was talking about how that when you're performing for a group of whether it's 3, 4, or 30, or 300, basically that each person has their own belief of what magic or mystery is, and so you have to kind of in a smaller when you're a street performer, you got people surrounding you, you can kind of relate because you can look them in the eye and kind of see where they are and try to relate to each person that way. When you're going to be having a mentalism show, that some people you know will have, gosh, I mean, aside from whatever religion that you might be, whether it's Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or Muslim, whatever it happens to be, and then within each of those sects. And then each individual within each religion has their own belief system of what they believe within that context of religion. So I would, and I'm talking about this from a religion standpoint because of mentalism affecting your mind, because that people seem to believe mentalism exists more than magic, because they know magic is, for the most part, just sleight of hand and
fun. We're heading into a five-hour discussion here. it's a subject which is very near and dear to my heart, because I choose, as you know, I've put out book tests and things like that.
Insight's a great book. Insight, test,
yeah.
My favorite.
Psychic Hangman running the numbers and several other items as well. But my performance is pure comedy magic because I still have a real issue with performing mentalism and what people in the audience will think of what I'm doing. And this is a personal thing. I mean, I would never criticize anyone else for doing what they do because that's not my place. This is me. I haven't worked it out yet. But I've had the discussion with many people, and it's a very interesting discussion, that people will use what we do to either back up what they do believe or back up what they don't believe. Yeah. And the interesting thing, it's not just religious people that believe in mind reading. Actually, a lot of atheists who have no religious connections or religious beliefs, they are still sort of trying to find something to believe in, and they want something extra. They want some otherness, if you like, to exist in the world, to make it have meaning. And ESP and secret powers and everything else is a kind of otherness that people will grasp onto. So there is, I believe, a definite...
So you think agnostics and atheists are easier to fool?
I don't think it has anything to do with whether they're agnostics, atheists, Christians, Muslims, or whatever. I don't think that has anything to do with it. I think there are people within all of those groups who are easy to fool and hard to fool. There are people in all those groups who are liberal thinkers and conservative thinkers. Well, there are people who are scientific and non-scientific, sure, and all those, you know.
Yeah, but I'm just saying stereotypically, you know, that there is something about stereotypes because that's true.
I mean, stereotypes, yeah.
Right. And so that's what I was asking about, whether you think that maybe some groups might be easier than others.
I don't really buy into that.
Okay.
I don't think so. We're both agreeing that
No.
We're in agreement.
And you asked me about after the show. I do give the disclaimer at the beginning of the show that I lie, steal, and cheat. And after the show, we're in a Penn and Teller type situation here. And I know a lot of people think that Penn and Teller are nice because they come out and meet everybody after their show in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the reason because they started in on Broadway. And there was only one door out of the theater, and they had to go out first, and that's the way that it is here.
Yeah.
So I know Keith, after his show, he goes out, and I go out, and I meet everybody that comes out of the door also. And so we get autographs and pictures and a lot of questions asked, and people will come up to me. For example, I end my show with the Zimmerman box prediction, but I explain that it's something during the show that I want to influence the audience to do, feel, or think, and we'll take it down at the end of the show and see how close we came. When I have people come out and they say, you know, I have no idea how you got that, how you influenced us on those things that you wrote in the box that was hanging from the ceiling. And I said, yeah, it's pretty cool, isn't it? However, if somebody comes up to me and said, was that box a trick? Yes, it was absolutely a trick. I tell them. So I have no problem with telling people.
Hmm.
Well, actually, one other thing about belief states.
Yes.
I just want to mention this because I think this is quite pertinent. You had a review on... about someone saying you didn't read any, you didn't speak to the dead or something like that. Didn't you?
Yes, yeah, I had
this
some.
This is another thing about audience expectations. Tell them that.
I had a really bad review that came through because they left the show and they were upset that I didn't talk to their dead relatives.
Were they respecting John Novak?
I've seen Bill's advertising. There's nothing on it that says anything about being, you know, speaking to dead people or anything like that. It talks about. Psychological illusion.
Mentalist and psychological illusion.
But they were expecting a John Edwards kind of a thing,
exactly.
I guess.
So, you know, you cannot meet audience expectations if the audience expectations are unmeatable. in that
right.
situation,
I think you got a good point there, Keith, where people actually come in with these preconceived notions, and that regardless of whatever that it says below the word mentalist or mind reader or something, you know, that they will interpret that as meaning psychic, fortune teller, you know, speaker to the dead. That's what they see that word meaning to them. So they come in with that belief system, and if you don't meet that expectation, it's like fail.
Kind of interesting because there's a lot of TV and stuff like this. There's a TV show called The Mentalist.
The Mentalist.
Is he a real mentalist? I've never seen it.
Great show. Simon Baker.
And then there's Psych, which I quite like Psych, actually.
Yep.
But I think in one sense, the kind of, if we can actually get that image to say, you know, we're more like the mentalists in The Mentalist and Psych than we are the, you know, I can't think of a picture of a mentalist.
That's what I explain.
Really,
yeah, exactly. That would be how I would explain
but
myself.
That's, So think. Yeah, that's kind of interesting, really.
That's a good idea. A good point. There is certainly a difference between the two, because Psych obviously is a comedy, but he makes it appear as if that he has these abilities in which he is using just normal observation, whereas the mentalist debunks psychics and says there's nothing, you know, with any of that. It's all just a bunch of hooey.
It's an interesting bigger picture in all of this because if you think back a couple of hundred years, now I know none of us are quite old enough to do that, but I remember reading stories, I think it was Robert Houdin used to, when he was doing the levitation with his son, used to release ether.
Ether, mm-hmm.
Which had just been discovered. So the audience could smell the ether and they could see the, you know, they didn't know all the powers of ether, but one of the powers, suggested powers, was making him weightless. And I seem to remember reading he had complaints about people saying it was wrong to do this to his son and to expose him to the chemicals and everything else. And I think, in one sense, magic back then was in the same position as mentalism is now. Back then, there were a lot of people that kind of really believed in magic powers.
True.
And they believed that the magician had real magic powers.
Well, you know,
illusions and things like that. Whereas nowadays, we don't believe the magician has real magic powers.
I disagree.
We do think the mentalist might have.
I think
the historical development is very interesting and deserves a lot more research.
But I think Keith, are still some people today in our society, not necessarily in third world nations, who have some belief system that cards are the devil's playthings, and I don't mess with this, and this is kind of beyond our thing. I actually had a follow-up, this has been some years back, but a guy who had said to me, now, isn't most magic just really tricks and sleight of hand? He said maybe like 80%. And I looked at him like, are you serious?
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, this was someone who was a businessman, you know, working in a professional place. And so I was surprised that, you know, he was absolutely serious in that regard and questioning that. Now, I'll also say, as far as mentalism goes, there again, when you're doing something with someone's mind and they don't understand it, they know that, well, perfect example. I've told this on the podcast in the past, but I'll mention it here briefly again, where I've done several closing dinners for financial groups, and there'll be a small group, let's say, where they've just put together this merger of a couple companies, and there'll be a board of directors, there'll be maybe 12 or 13 people or, you know, in the group, and I will do magic. And the companies have asked me back, you know, to do, I've done 100 plus shows, closing dinners like this, very nice, intimate in the wine cellar, you know, the top executives. And I've done several shows for these financial brokers. However, that occasionally when they've called me, I haven't been able to do it. So I had Banaschek fill in, and when Banaschek came, they have asked him to come back and perform for their companies, not necessarily for the broker, because the broker is the one who pays me and calls me to do it, the financial guys, but it's the companies who will call Banaschek back. And I talked with the secretary, with the financial broker, about why that was. She said, well, these guys work with numbers, you know, finances all day long, you know, big numbers and personnel issues and everything, and they know that what you're doing obviously is fun. You know, as Michael Lamar would say, bubblegum for the eyes. You know, it's just sleight of hand. They know it's fun and it's funny, and I'm doing comedy and, you know, a Bill and Lemon or whatever it is. But when he's doing things, he said they feel like he's reaching inside their minds and they can't figure that out, because they can figure out numbers and they can figure out other things, but it's just, you know, effect after effect that he's, you know, reaching in and, you know, twisting their mind just like he is with the forks and whatever else.
And it's that semi-belief.
Yes, exactly my point.
They feel they're having it's interesting because these people are almost having, although they might not use these terms, they're having a religious experience.
That's a very well put.
It is an experience which is causing them to question what they believe. Now, that will immediately have a much stronger emotional impact on people. And I believe that any form of entertainment is capable of that, but you have to get it right. In my show, I'm not trying to make people think. I'm trying to make people laugh until they are aching. Mm-hmm. That is what I'm trying to do. It's very much, there is a lot of magic in my show, a lot of strong magic in my show. Well, there's four tricks, but but it seems like a lot of magic the way I do it. I do them very slowly, and it's all comedy. So my thing is to make them laugh and take them on a journey of laughter and release. And it's a different kind of journey to the mentalist's journey.
Yeah,
you have a different kind of a journey, I understand. And so tell me a little bit then about your show and how that differs. Are you in the same theater? I assume
they're exactly the same venue, sometimes on the same day. Sort of shows run around about sort of 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock, so we do different times. I'm very much the new boy in town, and I'm experimenting with new times, and I'm hoping that we're going to be able to open this venue up and do some afternoon performances as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of very exciting things happening. But my show, again, is the classic, if people have seen me work, you know I'm very sort of interactive, very sort of street entertainer. That's my route as a street entertainer. And it is kind of like doing an hour and 15 minute street show indoors. Only, of course, I've got a lot more control over the audience, and I can sort of fire off more gags, because on the street there are more distractions. So I'm using all the experience I gained from working the headlining comedy clubs, and putting it all together to produce what I consider to be a family show, which will entertain 5-year-olds and 105-year-olds and everybody in between.
Do you use topical humor also? In other words, do you lift from today's headlines? I mean, do you change?
No, I don't lift from headlines, but I do a lot of stuff about being a Brit living in America, and I do a lot of misunderstanding stuff where I misunderstand what they're saying to me, because that's the great thing about being a Brit. I can actually create anything. I can pretend to misunderstand something and just say, oh no, that means something entirely different in England. if I do know exactly what it means, and it means the same thing. So I improvise a ton. I just go with the flow and try and make it funny. But it's kind of hard to, every show I do, although it has the same tricks, I could take a totally different route through those tricks.
Well, when you and I had worked together at the Midwest Magic Jubilee, I can certainly speak for that, you were a hit and people were laughing and crying with laughter, as well as that you put a lot of presentation into a very few tricks. Instead of having a bunch of tricks with a lot of lines, you know, you got a very specific kind of a thing that you would do, and you might take 12, 15 minutes or so with one trick.
I can tell you my whole show currently consists of cut and restored rope, bill in lemon, card in mouth, chop cut, and an escape routine, and that is an hour and 10 minutes of solid nonstop comedy. But that's the way my show is built. The way I look at it is the magic that I do is the framework onto which I hang the gags and the interaction with the audience. And that was my ambition. That's been working towards. And luckily, judging by the sort of reviews we get on TripAdvisor, that's pretty much what people are saying.
Yeah.
And I think I'm really, you know, I'm really doing it. So, I mean, the thing I'm most proud of is that I can actually get teenagers in the audience laughing as much as couples, you know, people in their early 20s and early 30s, and like they're laughing just as much. And then on the other side, there will actually be a family with some 7- and 8-year-old children, and they're laughing just as much. And when I see that happening, that to me is the real magic, when you can actually reach every age group and just make it happen. And that's kind of what I'm aiming at.
Have you ever had anything happen on stage that sticks out in your mind?
Talking good or bad.
Good or bad, whichever first thing comes to mind. Oftentimes it's a bad thing that happens. But
I did one routine where I'm doing an escape routine with the Houdini cuffs, and I got the Houdini cuffs caught, and I'm struggling with the jacket, and all of a sudden things are inside out, upside down, and I just get stuck, and I literally fall over and get tangled up in the curtain. It's just a mess. It was just an absolute mess, which is just absolutely hilarious. And then another time, have you ever used a smoke machine?
Yes.
I've got a smoke machine, which I use at one point during the show, and smoke machines, they cycle on and off.
Yeah.
I didn't actually realize this at the time.
Yes, they do.
At this point where I pick up the smoke machine to try and get this burst of smoke out, press the button, and nothing happened.
Nothing, right. It wasn't charged yet.
Going through its warming up cycle. So other things like, yeah, there's always disasters, but from my point of view, when something happens in the show which is unusual, that's another excuse for me to get creative and do some more jokes. Mm-hmm. So I just use anything that happens and make it a part of the show. And as far as the audience are concerned, that might happen every time, or it might never have happened. I just engulf everything and use it for comedy.
So since you have worked the streets and worked comedy clubs, you know how to improvise as necessary.
Yep, absolutely. It's at the heart of what I do, and it's probably what I love doing more than anything else. I love it when someone does something which they've never done before, because then I've got to think of a funny answer.
Now, that's just kind of the exact opposite of something with mentalism, particularly where you're talking about neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP, where that you are very specific sometimes, I would think, then, Bill, where your words that you choose are very specific, and you really can't improvise. So if someone answers differently, you can kind of go down one path. But do you find that a little bit more difficult?
No. Let me explain why. Because I'm certified. I'm a master hypnotist as well. I did a stage comedy hypnosis show for a long time. So I'm a master hypnotist. I also train people on how to do hypnotism, therapist, psychiatrist, psychologist, as well as entertainers. I also am certified in NLP. And I also train that to the same group of people as well as business people. I teach sales training, charisma enhancement, things like this. It's my belief, being a mentalist and a trainer on the other side, that you in a show, it's very, very, very difficult to influence anybody to do anything during a show when it comes to NLP or hypnosis or anything like that. I do explain a lot of my stuff with influence, and I do, guy, it's a red herring. If I do use NLP during my show, it's a red herring, and to throw people off. Sometimes it causes trouble and sometimes it doesn't. And what I mean is because I get business people that come up to me afterwards and they want me to come in because I do business consulting also for sales, customer service, and charisma enhancement. Mm-hmm. And I do go in, but I have to explain to them, listen, what you saw on stage, is it going to happen in front of a customer? That's not how it works. And so we have to back it down and regroup and then build it up from there. And so I think a lot of the, you know, you got Darren Brown and all the, and you have a lot of people explaining that it's NLP and stuff like that. And it's not. NLP is a good red herring on stage, is what it's used for.
Interesting.
It's
the difference between NLP and sort of mind reading, the way we sort of magically type mind reading in people, view it, is what we do works.
Okay.
We say it works. It works 100% of the time, every time we need it to work, because we're performers. We can't rely on something happening occasionally, because a show is a show.
Yeah.
And it's about the show, quite frankly. And even if you could genuinely do it 50% of the time, no, you can't afford to do that in a show, because that's not enough to make a show good.
No, that's a good point. I do have some things that I do on close-up when I get hired out to do like a cocktail party. Mm-hmm. And I have this one where I get four different colored cards, red, orange, yellow, and blue. And I have a spectator look at them, and they tell us what color they are. And with NLP and some hypnotic suggestion over about a 4 or 5 minute routine that I do, the colors actually change in front of their eyes. That will work for me about 80% of the time. And it's amazing to people sitting around them because they actually think that the colors of the cards changed.
Mm-hmm.
And but I can't do that on stage because here, just what Keith said, because of the reviews, it has to be consistent and it has to be right on.
Yeah. The last thing you want is four reviews in a row saying, it was very good, but that trick with the colored cards didn't work.
Right.
Yeah, apart from that, it was a good show. It was all right. But that colored card, I was upset by the colored cards not changing color. People write stuff like that on reviews. It is very bizarre.
So the
thing, we are beholden to our audience.
The things that go wrong for me, though, are it's my fault. I don't know if you've ever watched the TV show from the Discovery Channel called Moonshiners.
No.
I haven't either, but it's on there. And we had a couple of the stars from there in the show one night, and they insisted that I sample some moonshine before I went on stage. And
wow, I've had moonshine.
I ended up telling kids jokes during the show during that. another time, I called Banachek when I was putting this show together a couple years ago, and I asked him if I could use his book test. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you know how the book test works.
Yes.
And so during the book test, you use a ring to select the word.
The word, right.
And I had forgotten to put the ring on before I walked out on stage, so that kind of stuff is my fault. So that's what goes wrong, but it's my stupidity.
Well, as far as things going wrong, I want to ask about inserting new effects, and particularly your show. You were talking about how that you had changed up a few weeks ago, your opening there, Bill, whereas Keith, you've got a solid routine that works for you, and really that it's not so much a trick, so much it is the lines probably that get changed out for you.
I have other tricks that I could do. Yeah. I haven't this run. I've kept the thing, sort of the main thing solid. There is actually one routine that I really want to put in the show because I want to change a pace before my finale. And I do a card routine with an overhead camera. It's a version of the McDonald's Aces.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to put that in, but it means putting in projectors and things like that. I want it mainly because it creates a good change of pace just before the finale. So I have other stuff that I want to put in. But, yeah, gags are always changing.
But and, Bill, as far as your show, that there would be some things from time to time that you might want to put in. And you have a good opportunity when you're doing it over and over to see, okay, well, I need to tweak that. I think the trick is right, but maybe I just need to stand differently or choreograph this a little, you know, block this scene a little bit differently. Or you might just say, this just didn't work, I'm going to take it out. And I think because of TripAdvisor, and for those who who don't know in podcast land, whoever in other countries might be unfamiliar with that. That's basically an online internet thing that is a audience generated reviews of shows and restaurants and that kind of a thing. So you can kind of live and die, you know, by that, just like cruise ship magicians would by those reviews from the passengers. But I'm just asking about swapping things in and out of a show. How do you go about doing that, putting in something into a show without the audience saying, oh, that was horrible, and giving you a bad review?
One at a time. One at a time. Sure. And okay. I explain. I said, listen, we're going to try something new tonight, and we'll see how it goes. And I'm pretty honest about it. And,
I see.
So they know. And I do it one at a time. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't feel right for me. It's a really good concept on paper. I get it out in front of the audience, and it just didn't feel right. It wasn't my personality. It wasn't my superpower that I can do. And so we'll drop it right away. Other times it's just, okay, the audience reacted to it this way, but they didn't react to it this way. And so we'll tweak it a little bit and try it the next night and then tweak it some more. And over about a 2 to 3 week period, since we do do so many shows, you can tweak it pretty quickly and get it up to where you want it. So it's scripted out. And my wife is my assistant in the show, and she does several things and takes photos. And so we have a meeting after every show. And I say, how did it go, and what do you think about this? And she'll give me her tips, and she's usually right about it. So, and the thing with the theater down here, though, since we're in a it's a tourist attraction. So since we're in this tourist area, I for example, just what is this? This is Monday, right? Saturday night, I had a family that was here, and this is their third time in a period of 2 years of being to the show. And the show has to change periodically because – we have new people, and there's a couple different ways to look at this. Number one, you go back to like Aerosmith, and you see them perform the same songs every time, and you like it, and they're always going to perform the same songs. However, I want to change my show just a little bit, so about once a month, I will add something new and take something else out or change it slightly, so when people come back to see the show, it's not exactly the same show that they saw before.
I think that's a good thing to do for your own personal development as well,
sure.
Because I think some performers get very much into this is my show, and there is a thing about the longer you're doing the show, the more polished those individual bits get.
But you also lose some freshness, potentially.
Well, that's the danger. Losing freshness is the danger. Even if you can keep the freshness, putting something new against something which is established, sometimes the new bit will look a bit rough. So I think if you're always putting new stuff in, then that becomes part of the show. I'm getting to the point in my show now when I drop a new bit in, and that new bit will develop and grow, or it'll become a piece, or you'll put it down and go back to it later. And so I think we should always, in every single show, try and do something new. Lee Evans, one of my favorite comics, said to me once, he said, if you do a new funny line every time you go on stage, at the end of a year, you've got a new act.
That's right.
And I thought that was a very interesting piece of logic. Which I try and do. So every show I do, I try and come up with a couple of new lines that I've never said before and then write them down afterwards, and then I've got them there for next time.
And Keith and I were just talking before we connected here, and with you, Scott. And, I have a book test in my show.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm thinking, and I've been thinking about it for a few days now, of replacing the book test for a while just to see what the audience reaction is with, and I don't even know what you call it, but what would you call it, Keith? It's the
I can't remember what it was we were talking
the
about.
Column, the column with the scissors.
Oh, the
Clippo?
Clippo, that was
Clippo,
it.
Yes. Clippo, yes. It was something like that.
Or Snipper?
Yeah, so I'm thinking
I
about...
I thought it was called Snippet or something, but
yeah.
I think it is called
Is Clippo. That Chuck Hickok's Snipper thing?
Clippo, I think, was the one I write.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I was thinking about replacing the book test with that sort of routine just to see what kind of reaction it got with the audience. And if it doesn't work, I'll go back to the book test.
I just want to say your mime of Clippo then was absolutely horrible. I thought you were milking a cow in the show. I'm sorry, I went totally blank. But,
by the way, while you're on that reminds me of a great idea that Mark D'Souza has using the Clippo effect or the snipper thing, where that's you would have a printed out like the receipt from a grocery store, and you have a prediction then to begin with. And so whenever wherever you want them to clip it, they do, they pick it up off the floor and they look, and it says Lay's potato chips, 37 cents or $2.37, whatever.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you open up the envelope, and you got the UPC gag. And then when you turn over, it says Lay's potato chips, $2.37.
Gotcha.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was a nice presentation and a nice kicker to a gag. Something different.
Yeah.
Going back to the show then itself, and where this is there in Gatlinburg, and how that you found this, I wanted to kind of circle back to what we started about initially there, Bill, as far as you know, when we talked at the East Coast Mind Jam, that you were saying how that you had a long-term contract and how that you fell into this. Just tell a bit about that story. I think it's
This is your story, Bill, because I had nothing to do with
and
this.
And Keith has another story. Yeah. And so there's
I want to hear that too. Great.
It's crazy. So I did the stage comedy hypnosis show for the corporate market for 23 years. And I have DVDs out, and so I would lecture also. And that's how Keith and I met. I think Keith came to Columbus and lectured, and I listened to him, and then we ended up lecturing together in Pittsburgh someplace, right? Pennsylvania, somewhere over there. West Virginia, I don't know, somewhere, at a convention. And, after 23 years of doing the hypnosis, I liked it, but it was just getting boring. I wanted a new challenge. And I dabbled with mentalism, but never for the public, just for friends and family. And if we would go out, I would do a few things. And so I told my girlfriend, who is now my wife at the time, I said, it's either Vegas, Gatlinburg, Branson, or Atlantic City, maybe Myrtle Beach. I said, but I got to get someplace. Instead of touring, I want to see if I can get a theater, but I want to do the mentalism. So I packed up everything I had. I stopped booking for the hypnosis show, and I moved to Gatlinburg, Tennessee. And I did something that most people won't do. I took a job as a server at Hard Rock Cafe because I needed to pay the bills. And the reason I did that is because I began to call down to the theaters in Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge, and nobody really knew me. Nobody would talk to me. And I figured I have to put myself in front of them. So I came down here, and I just walked into every theater that I could. And I happened to walk into the one that we're in now, and they said that they wanted to meet with me. And I met with them for about 2 hours, and we got along. And they said, well, we're going to have to see you perform. And it was right at the time that Eric Dittleman was on America's Got Talent.
Good timing.
And so they loved the mentalism, and they loved Eric. And so they knew, had an idea of what mentalism was, and they had already liked it. And so I said, okay, what do you want me to do? They said, give us 30 minutes of your best stuff, and we'll be in town, because they live 2 hours away. We'll be in town next week, and you can perform it, and we'll let you know. So they came in the next week. But during that week, I had never performed mentalism for a public. I had to put together 30 minutes of
the
show.
You were lying, stealing, and cheating.
I did. That's what I did, lie, steal, and cheat. And so they came in. There was about 7 or 8 of them in the room. It's a family. No reactions for 30 minutes. No laughter. No applause. No anything. It was like being on American Idol. And so nothing. But I did my routine, and I never have gotten nervous on stage, never have gotten nervous for anything like this in my life. But this time I was nervous because I was getting no reaction. And
you were using them as volunteers to come up on stage.
I was using them as volunteers. And I said, well, and so I did 30 minutes, and they said, all right, we'll give you a call. And later that night I got a call, and they said, we like you. Let's work something out. And that's how I got in here. And I quit my job at the Hard Rock Cafe that same day.
You were desperate by any chance,
were
you?
No. And that's why. I mean, I did what it took to get what I wanted, and most people won't do that. That's why a lot of people say they want things, but they just don't get them.
And so when you negotiated the contract with them, you thought it was going to be for how long? A year, 2 years?
Yeah, we signed for 2 years originally. Now we got it up to 7 years. I got 6 years left on it, 5 years and some odd months, but left on that. What I did, though, was it's opened up some opportunities. I knew they liked Eric Dittleman, and so he was already a friend of mine on Twitter, and I had him come down, and he did two shows with me in June of 2013. Went really well, and then Keith, did I call you, or how did that work out?
I can't remember. I think we were just sort of keeping in touch and chatting, and I was asking Bill how it was going, and it was just a case. I think I said I'd love to do something like that, but I haven't got the situation. And Bill just said, "Well, why don't you come down and see if you can do anything down here?" And I didn't even know where here was at the time. I didn't know anything about Gatlinburg. I'd only been in America 3 years, or when we started talking about it, or something like that. So to cut a long story short, I came down for a weekend last year, and I did two nights here just to have a look at the venue, have a look at the town, and Bill filmed the show and showed it to the owners, and they absolutely loved the show, and we've then spent a year sort of trying to work out how we could make it work. because there are already two shows going on in the venue, so I'd be a third show in the venue. So working between us and, you know, different times and different shows and all that kind of thing, there is a lot of stuff to get sorted out, and can we make it work, will it work, everything else. I think we've sort of got most of the I's dotted and T's crossed, or the other way around.
It's moving in the right direction.
So yeah, we're moving in the right direction now. So I'm just coming to the end of my first 6-week run, because I think, truth be told, the way things are at the moment here, this venue can run 3 acts in the busy times, but not in the quiet times.
Now, when you're saying that, that would certain seasons, you mean the summer versus winter?
Yeah, we have a spring break here as a peak season for us, yeah, and then middle of June to the middle of August, and then October gets a little busy because of the fall colors and the mountains and the leaves down here.
Mm-hmm. And October, then and Halloween as well.
Halloween too, yeah, yeah, and then we have Thanksgiving and Christmas. Those are our peak seasons. Other times, it's either feast or famine. There's nobody in town on the other, yeah, times.
So it's kind of not good. If we had 3 shows going on in this little 100-seat theater, we'd be competing for the same audience, and we're not doing ourselves any favors. You know, it would be much better to have 1 show with 100 people in than 3 shows with 30 people in, because the individuals who come to see the shows would have a better show. So it's all that balancing, I think, that we're still... You know, the management are still working all that out.
What is the third show? What is the other one? That's
it's a hip show. Comedy hypnosis show. Yeah.
Okay. And but those are 3 separate shows. So those are 3 separate tickets, and I would think that people can come back and see all three.
Sell on. Yeah, I mean, people come to see shows when they like the venue, because we are in Tennessee here, and most of the shows around are very much.
Music.
Know, hillbilly. They're redneck. Shows,
right, yeah, they're music.
That's the basis of the comedy and the comedy barn, and there's Hatfield and McCoy's up the road and all this kind of thing. So you can go to a hillbilly show. We're not doing hillbilly shows. We're doing sort of much more upmarket, fun, the sort of show that you'd see in any big city.
That's what I was going to say. This is more of a corporate kind of a thing that you would see in what I'd call a civilized area, as opposed to something that's going to be in a backwoods redneck hillbilly.
I think he called the people of Tennessee uncivilized.
Indirectly. Yeah.
I hope there aren't too many of them listening to this.
Let me be more direct.
You know, your friend, though, wants to have a show here, right?
I'm sorry, say it again.
I said your friend wants to have a show here.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. He does. And thought about that some years ago, about opening up a coffee shop in the front and, a show in the back, and just call it the Mystic Cup.
Yeah. So.
But anyhow, so as far as the rest of the competition, I'm just saying that it would be an unusual place to have this kind of entertainment, which, when I'm saying sophisticated, it, as you had just first pointed out, that it does have a lot of hillbilly type of influence with that kind of music and country music, et cetera, and that kind of comedy with a hee-haw type of stuff, if people remember that old TV show.
Yeah,
but that kind of a thing, and then when you bring your type of entertainment with those 3 types of shows, you know, with mentalism and hypnotism and then comedy magic, that is something that people would like to see on television, but is so different from what that they come expecting to see as a tourist to that location.
And I think really people have 0 expectation
when
they come to our shows, because they don't know. People really don't have an idea of what a mentalist is. They don't have much of an idea of what a hypnotist is. And actually, when it comes to, they may have an idea of what they think a comedy magician is, but when they see me, that idea is going to be blown out of the water, because I am so far from your traditional American model of a comedy magician.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm really a comedian who happens to do a few magic tricks.
And to tell you the truth, it's the TripAdvisor and other areas that other places that you get reviews from. People read the reviews and they see that we have the top shows in Gatlinburg. Yeah. And the Pigeon Forge area, and so instead of picking because of content, they pick because it's a top show. They don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
And you're saying it's a 100-seat theater?
Yeah. 90. Yeah. 90, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, 100 if we put the extra chairs in.
That's right.
And
yeah.
Don't tell the fire department.
Well, that sounds like a pretty intimate show, certainly.
It is. We're actually sitting in the venue now. There's literally there are 4 rows of seats, and they're sort of in a sort of semi horseshoe type of thing around us. And it really is, there's not a bad seat in the house.
Are they fixed theater seats that are...
Yeah, they're comfortable. They're the typical fixed theater seats with a drinks holder, just like you get in a cinema or something. Probably where they came from, a cinema or something like
probably,
that.
Probably, yeah.
And it is just a very intimate, cozy little venue. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah, the front block is 10 wide, and there's sort of 5 wide to the left and 5 wide to the right on the horseshoe. So
is there not a center aisle?
No central aisle. There's two aisles at the sort of two 45-degree angles from the stage.
Right.
To give you a bit of a picture. The whole thing is a work in progress in many ways, and our shows are work in progress because that's the joy of this kind of a situation. You know, we are continually making the venue better. We are continually making the shows better. You know, bringing new bits of kit and things like that. It's exciting to watch it unfold, I think.
I was about to ask, with a small theater like that you can do some really intimate things, and I was thinking like almost like a seance kind of a thing where the different things would happen in the theater, that you could rig the theater for things to fly or touch people or whatever. But then
typically yes, but it's a no-no around here. I would love to, get me wrong.
The seance bit is a no-no.
I would love to do something like that, but the seance bit is a no-no in this area.
Oh, that's what I was getting at. Just going back, again, full circle to our conversation earlier.
Described to me a couple of days ago as the buckle of the Bible Belt.
Yeah.
Now, whatever you think of the Bible Belt, good or bad, that doesn't matter, but this is definitely right there.
Well, do you have those audience members from time to time when you say, I want you to select a playing card, and they have no idea what the card value is?
I haven't had it yet, but it wouldn't surprise me. I have had it doing card tricks in America. Doing close-up, that people said, no, I don't do card tricks. Yeah. And I was going, sorry? And it was a religious statement, which I didn't catch.
I've had that happen just once, and it was in the South, in Alabama somewhere.
I was told I could do some balloons for the kids, but no magic.
Hmm.
And I went, oh, sorry, I only do balloons for people that watch magic, because I'm easily offended.
So when people come in, that they don't have an expectation of the show necessarily, but they know it's going to be some sort of magic. I don't suppose you've ever had anybody walk out because of their beliefs.
The show is called A Brit of Magic. So it sums up. They know it's a magic show when they come in. They know it's a comedy show because it says the funniest show in Gatlinburg as a strap line. So they know it's going to be a comedy magic show. But there is a... the classic comedy magician doing banana bandana and that's the funny bit of the show, and the rest of it is a few doves, and that's not me. You know, everything I do is, I use the expression comedy club funny because I'm a comedy club headliner. I headline comedy clubs all across America. Firstly, there aren't many magicians who are actually headlining comedy clubs. There are a few who are working in comedy clubs, but actually, if you quiz them, the truth is most of them are featuring or emceeing.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to headline a comedy club, you've got to be as funny as the comedians, because they're not magic clubs, they're comedy clubs. And that's kind of where I come from. 30 years of doing that in the UK, working the university circuit and everything else. It's comedy, 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 with the strong magic interjected at the right places.
Now, how did you get to be a comedy magician then, necessarily, Keith? Because I know some people have taken improv schools, or some people just exercise their creative muscles. Some might have just been born funny, I guess. How did you come about or fall into...
I started out as a street entertainer, as many know, and I quickly learned that the way to get money out of people was to make them like you on the street, and the way to get them to like you is to make them laugh. When people are laughing, and I think there's a very important thing, they have to be laughing with you. You know that character, every so often you get someone that really is just a great guy at a party and everyone likes, and he makes everyone feel good about themselves?
Sure.
That's kind of what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to make them feel good about themselves, and if they say something which I get a laugh at, as an audience member, I want them to feel that we're laughing with them and not at them. And I take control of the comedy and make sure that it is very much situational and relationship-based. And because it's as opposed to target based, there's a very distinct difference between the two.
Exactly, there is, and that was what I was going to get at, because there certainly is a cultural difference in my opinion and experience from English comedians and English comedy versus American, because...
We are very target-based in English.
Yeah, exactly, very target. And I'm thinking about Terry Seabrook and so many others, It seems like that you're kind of making fun of the, their clothing or whatever, their demeanor.
I've been guilty of that in the past as well. But say now I've had this whole change of tack, and those words are key. It's about situation and relationship, not about targets. I've actually just written a sequence of articles for Vanish magazine that I write for about comedy and, you know, how magicians can use comedy and things like that, which are starting, actually started in this month's episode. And it's kind of interesting. And that's when I actually came up with the term, the difference in term between situation and relationship is good, target is bad. And, you know, that's kind of where
I'm going.
But
that's something you had to change. You recognized that you had that type of humor as an Englishman?
Develop and learn. American audiences are very different from English audiences. American audiences are much more willing to join in and have a good time. English audiences, you have to fight for every laugh you get. But English audiences are much more combative as well. You know, they don't mind you roughing it up a bit, whereas American audiences are much more sensitive. And I frequently make lines, say lines which are just sort of one line too many. I had a guy come in yesterday, he came in late. And just next door to us, there's one of those arcades that people win tickets and they can get prizes, you know, the kind of thing.
Sure.
And as he walked in, I said, oh, have you been playing in the arcade? He went, yeah. And I said, did you win many tickets? He went, yeah, loads. I said, well, you should have gone over there and got yourself a watch. The show started 5 minutes ago. you know, I was just, and I could sense as soon as I said that, that's, in England, that's a, that would be a huge laugh. But yeah. In here, it was just a little bit, ooh. That was a bit too personal. And inside, there's nothing inside me that says that can be offensive. But I know that inside other people, even what I consider a mild line like that could be taken the wrong way.
Well, that's another thing, going back and trying to hit each person in the audience. That is that you might offend one person. And when you have a large audience, that's one thing. If you're doing something in a close-up context where you kind of feel like, well, I have the audience with me and I understand, you know, I can kind of test the audience. So, you know, if I can say something a little bit more blue humor that they would appreciate or others that make sure it's squeaky
and
clean.
And as Phil was saying, we're in a really unique situation here because we don't have one person, i.e. the booker, that we have to please. We have 80 or 100 people sitting in our audience. Each one of those people, if we offend them, can give us a bad review. Now, as a street entertainer, there's a technique that we use, which Gazzo probably based his whole career on, which was offend half the audience, and then you'll get much more money out of the other half.
You
know, and it's that sharp, hard-hitting humor on the street works very well because you're weeding out people who probably wouldn't have given you any money anyway. So you can afford to have targets in that scenario.
Interesting.
But in a theatre situation, they've paid their money already. They don't want to be targets. So you've got to actually make that change to relationship and situational comedy, which is much gentler and actually much funnier. And I believe the way I'm trying to do it, I want the audience members to feel that they are the ones that got the laughs. I had a great moment the other day. I was doing Bill and Lemon, and this woman took she picked up the knife, and she was holding the knife, and I was holding the lemon, and I hadn't got around to cutting it half in yet, but she took the knife, and she held it up to me, and she said, now give me my $10 back. So it's a classic, because I was being mugged by a member of the audience that I borrowed the bucks from, and it was actually a very funny situational moment, but she did it. That's what I mean. It's not me, it was her. All I'm trying to do is create scenarios where the members of the audience can actually come out themselves and do funny things as well, and they're safe to do that.
Right.
So, you know, she gets the credit. Well, I get the credit for it because they're laughing at my show. But, you know, she feels really good because she got a big laugh, and I don't go, oh, no, you stop being funny. It's my job to be funny, not yours. None of that stuff. A laugh is a laugh. I'll take it.
That's true. Yes. You want to try and make people feel comfortable on stage.
Yeah. Actually, I was going to make a comment earlier, just if I can jump back to Bill does in his show. The comedy that Bill uses quite often is you are doing a very innocuous line in a moment when there is a certain amount of discomfort in the room because something odd, something mental, something mind-readery is going to happen. And those little moments when there's tension in the room and you break that tension with something which is amusing and then the laughter, a beautiful kind of laughter, ripples through the room. And it's almost a laughter of relaxation.
And it's
getting those moments of heightened tension, and all you need to do is give it a little flick, and you get a laugh out of the audience because of the heightened tension in the room. And there's all these different forms of comedy that can go on in shows. It's fascinating.
Directors use that in movies, I think, too.
Yeah, yeah. Simon Lovell does this thing about the... he talks in his lecture about the horror films, about how... You know, there's a guy walking up around the road and he sort of walks around the corner and all of a sudden, thump, there's an axe comes down. And then a couple of minutes later in the film, there's a guy walking down the road. He goes around the corner and thump, an axe comes down. And then 5 minutes later, same guy walking around the corner and everyone's expecting the axe. and you go around the corner, and there's a little kitten there. And everyone goes, "Ah, little kitten," and then thunk, the axe comes in. You know, and it's all about playing with people's emotions in those moments of, who is it? Hang on a second, Lee Asher's book. Is it Tension and Relaxation in Card Magic? Is that his book?
I think so, yeah.
Very technical stuff about card magic. That tension and relaxation also applies to comedy. Creating moments of tension and breaking the tension and a moment of relaxation, and the break between the two is the laughter. That was
something that Simon had taught me, just a quick little line whenever that you are producing a card and someone says it was the King of Diamonds or something, and then you know you're holding a card and you're saying, "Oh," and you kind of give that moment, it's like, "Oh, you missed it," and then you turn around and say, "Almost missed it."
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, so, and it is that moment, create tension, and that relaxation will actually be a lot more powerful when you hit them.
And when you look at that physically, also you drop your shoulders and everything. You have to. Yeah. It's play acting. I'm sorry, Bill. You were going to say?
No.
That is. Yeah.
We're all agreeing.
I was agreeing.
Oh, okay. I can hear you nodding over there.
We're all right. If only they asked us, we could solve any problems.
Okay, well, so as we start to wrap up, tell me some more about then where that they can go to get tickets, find out information, a website or something that will tell us about the shows.
We don't have websites, do we? We like to keep our shows in the 1970s and 1980s.
There you go.
We go for the old-fashioned approach of having no one in the audience.
There's for my tickets, you can go to my website, which is BillGladwellLive.com.
Or for mine, you can go to keithfields.com. That's probably the easiest thing. You can find everything about there. There's links to this show and the other stuff I do. And there's also links there to my magic shop, Keith Fields Magic, where you can see my product range and lecture stuff and other info which you may be interested in.
And the theater is located in the bottom of the Space Needle in Gatlinburg, so you can't really miss it.
The Space Needle is a huge tower. It's a lookout tower, which you can go up in an elevator to the top. It's like Charlie and the Glass Elevator and all that stuff. It's quite fun. So it's just look up till you see the big tower, which is beautifully lit up at night now because they've just put some nice lights on it. And just go down until you get to the theater at the bottom.
Yeah, and I do something very unique in my show here. If anybody is listening to this and they want to hire me for a corporate gig, this is not going to happen. But for the show in here, I offer a money-back guarantee at the end of my show. So if I didn't meet or exceed your expectations, is what I explain, I'll refund you and your party's tickets in full. So really, nobody has anything to lose to come to my show.
Yeah, I say the same thing as well.
Do you?
Yeah, I started doing it. I do it at the beginning, though. The reason I do it at the beginning is I figure that by the end they've probably forgotten that I said that. I'm not taking any chances.
Very good. And then just quickly to wrap up, the name of my podcast, of course, is called The Magic Word. And so my question to both of you would be what your magic word might be, and not necessarily abracadabra. It could be, you know, something that you might use in the context of your show or something perhaps in your life that might be your mantra, your motto, your what is it you live by. It could be a word or a phrase or something. So what's your magic word?
I have a phrase that I kind of live by, which I kind of like, and I've got no idea where it actually originates from. But a phrase that I live by is, the answer's yes, what is the question?
Oh, I like that.
And it's kind of, I know there was Yes Man, it was the film and that sort of thing, but it came way before that. But that's kind of way I try and live my life, is I definitely live my showbiz life like that, is if anyone gives me an opportunity, rather than thinking, oh, can I do that, should I do that, will it work, won't it work, I just go, yes, let's just do it and see what happens. And that's kind of how I ended up coming down here, really. I was kind of how I ended up moving to America as well, to be quite honest. It was like my brother said, why don't you move to America? I went, all right then. And then Bill said, why don't you come down here and try doing a show in Gatlinburg? And I went, all right then. But I like to take risks. I like to do different things. I think life should be a roller coaster ride, not a Sunday afternoon drive in the countryside. And I want to get as much out of it as I possibly can. And I hope that I impart that to people in my shows as well, that when they come, they hop on the roller coaster with me. And, you know, we have the ups and the downs and the exciting bits. And at the end, we get off all exhausted and happy and go our own separate ways, never to meet each other again. But I'll be slightly richer because they've bought a ticket.
I guess I have a phrase. It depends on the situation you're in, if you're a salesperson or if you're a business person or if you're in the theater business like we are, the entertainment. You don't need more friends, you need more clients. Or you don't need more clients, you need more friends. Or you don't need more audience members, you need more friends. So I treat everybody that comes into the theater here and everybody that I do business with in the corporate market, in my consulting business, with – as a friend. I want to make them my friend, and I treat them as a friend. And I wouldn't do anything to any of my audience members or anybody that's in the corporate market that I work with that I wouldn't do with a friend sitting in front of me. So I live my life that way. That's why I meet everybody after the show, and I think that's why my customer service is so well.
So friendship really is a word. Well, great. Thank you very much. I appreciate Keith Fields for you being on the podcast here with us and the guest
today.
You're
only saying that because I'm here, Scott.
You're exactly right.
You wouldn't have said that, would you?
I wouldn't have. And Bill Gladwell, I thank you very much for having the show and inviting Keith to join you out there as well and for being my guest today.
Oh, well, thank you, Scott. Thanks
and don't forget, guys, come and see the show anytime, and you can take us out for a drink afterwards.
There you go.
I know for my show, any magician or mentalist or anybody in the business, I let them in for free. So
yeah, likewise. So we love to have guests who are magicians. They just have to email us in advance, and we can usually sort that out. Obviously, if we're sold out. Sold out? Did I say sold? I
think sold out.
Sold out, Ben, and I didn't mean that. I just,
you've already started drinking, so someone's buying you free drinks already. It's not Martini and Thursday, Magic Martini.
If we're not sold out, and people email us in advance, we can usually sort something out for them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Super. Thank you guys very much. I appreciate you joining us on this podcast. So for the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out.